The Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. According to the International Criminal Court, it has confirmed that there is a reasonable basis to believe that members of the British Armed Forces committed the war crimes of willful killing, torture, inhumane cruel treatment, outrages upon personal dignity, and rape and or other forms of sexual violence. And what do you think the ICC did when they found out this information? They closed the case. That's right. We will be taking a look at Western privilege in the international arena and the lack of accountabilities for lives lost or destroyed in developing countries in this debate this hour. I'd like to welcome to the program out of London, Press TV's Richard Sudan, and out in Edinburgh, author and commentator John White. Thank you both for being with us. Starting it off with Richard. Well, Richard, tell me about what's being said on that side of things. It is quite curious that after admitting that there were war crimes committed, that the ICC then closed the case.
I mean, I think, Marzia, in your introduction, you mentioned the phrase Western privilege, and I think that's a really good starting point. I mean, frankly, there are going to be scores of human rights lawyers and experts, scores of anti-war activists that are going to be looking at the decision by the chief prosecutor, who said there's no case for the British to answer to, with utter disbelief, because in spite of all of the accounts, all of the testimony, all of the evidence that's been put forward, really, in addition to what we already knew, it seems something that, on the one hand, there's been some sort of admission that the British Army military command did indeed contribute to suspected war crimes committed against the Iraqi detainees. But on the other hand, I think the decision mentioned that it's satisfied that the British authorities conducted their own investigation. On what planet, amid what semblance of fairness and true democracy, can the party which is being accused of committing the war crimes somehow be, the vindicator that there were none committed? It beggars belief, and I suspect, the international community is really looking at this decision with a kind of side-eye squint, also in a sense of disbelief, as are much of the British people.
All right. Well, John, let me get you in on this conversation. What do you make of this? How is that, from a legal perspective, I mean, how does it make sense? So there is a court. The court says, yes, we see proof of war crimes being taken out and that's taken place, and yet the case is closed. And what type of signal, what message does this basically send to the world?
Well, good evening, and good evening, Richard. There are times when the truth is not enough, and when only the unvarnished truth will do. And when we come to an unvarnished truth of this development, let us be honest, this is not about Western privilege per se, this is about white supremacy. The problem disfiguring our world today is not the lack of democracy within states, it's the lack of the democracy between states. And this merely confirms it, because what we have are a clutch of Western imperialist countries, of which the UK is a prime member, who do not see themselves as upholders of international laws, but arbiters of international laws, which means to say they get to decide what constitutes war crimes and what does not. And in this case, what we're seeing is the white supremacy of the British imperial state at work. Its soldiers can never be accused or prosecuted for committing war crimes. Because why? Because they're on the good side in this eternal war against the black and brown other. No ifs, no buts, no maybes.
Let me also welcome our next guest. Out of London, author and political commentator, Jonathan Fryer. Jonathan, thanks so much for being with us. Now, Jonathan, the reason the ICC says it is dismissing this is because the UK is investigating itself. Your take on what exactly that means?
Well, there have really been two stages to the British investigation. For several years up until 2017, there was something called the Iraq Historic Allegations Team, or IHAT. And they had legal teams in court which listened to the claims of people from Iraq who said that they had been tortured or mistreated in various ways. And there were well over 3,000 such claims. And although 70% were dismissed as perhaps unreliable, that still meant that hundreds of people had got legitimate claims. But in fact, the cases fell apart because of the evidence not being strong enough. And instead, what's happened is that now the British military themselves are looking into any prolonged appeals. And it was interesting that the ICC, in its judgment in abandoning the case, now has said that they did believe that the British military were looking at this. But of course, for the victims and their families, there is no justice in this.
Well, now, John, do you think that for international organizations such as the ICC, that the value of lives differ depending on the part of the world one is from?
Oh, indeed, yes. We live in a world underpinned by the values of might is right rather than right is might. And the IEC in this decision has proven itself to be unfit for purpose. We need to move beyond this idea that a certain group of countries based on military might and economic power have the right to determine what is just and what is not just. If these were Iranian troops, if these were Venezuelan troops, if these were Cuban troops involved in these activities or accused of these activities, it would be an entirely different narrative. This is about imperialism, no ifs, no buts. And I just have to say this. I am appalled as a citizen of the United Kingdom how dehumanized people of Iraq, of Syria, of Iran have been treated in terms of their value. And they have been pushed outside the circle of human worth that is established in the name of Western imperialism. And this is a very, very sordid and squalid turn of events. And I hope many people in the West will finally wake up to the injustice and the barbarism and the cruelty that has been perpetuated in their name. And unless they do, the world is headed for perdition. This is nothing more than imperial power writ large. There is no justice here. There is no legal pretext here. It's all about power. And until we move beyond that and move into a world where it's about underpinned by justice, regardless of country, regardless of culture, then, I foresee that we're headed for a very bad end.
Jonathan, ICC prosecutor Fatou Bensouda says that the UK has been using mechanisms to investigate itself, but then admits that this 10-year investigation has not led to anyone being convicted. It's quite amazing that on the one hand, she's saying that they are capable of actually judging themselves, but on the other hand, no one has been convicted and paid a price. So as our other guest said, would it be the same thing if we were talking about another country such as Iran or, as he said, Venezuela?
Well, it might well be different in those cases. One can't know unless a particular case comes before. As I mentioned earlier, the problem in the case of British soldiers in Iraq that the evidence was not strong enough linked to individual soldiers or commanders that would actually enable
Jonathan, who determined that the evidence was not strong enough? The ICC?
The ICC accepted what the British had, the British government and the British military had decided through the Iraqi
problem right there.
And that what we have a situation, though, I think we have to admit, and probably John would agree with me on this, is that the real problem is the whole idea of European or North American countries intervening in a situation such as Iraq. Many millions of people, including myself in Britain, demonstrated against the Iraq war and thought it was a terrible mistake. And those sorts of interventions in countries that have a completely different culture and ethnicity and so on almost inevitably lead to various types of abuses. And this is something which I think has to be approached, and I would say in two ways. First of all, that these sorts of interventions should not be entered into as lightly as they have in the past. And secondly, the rules of engagement need to be much more closely monitored so that people are not able to commit the sort of abuses which undoubtedly happened in the case
of
Iraq.
Jonathan, you're just jumping in here, listening to what you're saying, but at the end of the day, you say that they should not, these countries like the UK, should not be involved or not get involved very easily or lightly in these regions, but of course they do. And on the other hand, the ones who are paying the price are the people of this region, not the aggressors, not the ones that are coming in. At the end of the day, if we're looking at, for example, Iraq, that millions of people have been displaced. That country has never gone back to the where it was prior to the war. Yes, Saddam Hussein is gone, but so is security and so many other things. And so many people have been tortured, and so much abuse has taken place. So then the question is, so who pays? Who pays? We're looking right now at the ICC saying, well, the Brits are going to investigate themselves, but these were the same ones, based on a lie, who went into the country to begin with, that they had no right to go into, because of course we know now that there were no weapons of mass destruction.
Well, I agree, Marzia, absolutely, that the intervention in 2003 was not only unjustified, but as many of us would believe, totally illegal. But we have a situation when you say who is going to pay for what has happened in Iraq, and it is a tragic case. It is unfortunately many of the individual citizens and the communities in Iraq who are paying the price, and it's a terribly high price, which is why there needs to be a complete rethink, as I said, of engagement in foreign wars and foreign interventions.
Okay. Jonathan, let me get John back in on this. Yeah. John, do you think that this verdict from the ICC prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, is connected at all to what happened back in September when Bensouda and the ICC ruled that there was enough evidence to investigate the U.S. for war crimes in Afghanistan? And after that ruling, the U.S. sanctioned her. Do you see any type of connection that perhaps there are threats, intimidation being exerted on her? Your thoughts on that side of things.
Well, there's absolutely a connection here. I mean, but I just need to go back to something Jonathan said. Jonathan Fry is somebody that I hold in the highest esteem, but I must take exception to his description of the war in Iraq as a mistake. Nomenclature is very important before it unlocks the keys to human consciousness. This war was not a mistake, it was a crime. It was a war crime, it was an atrocity. And the problem that we have in British culture is that every war since the Second World War is perceived and is presented as a rerun of the Second World War, i.e. the good war, i.e. that we are the good guys in this war, and that who we are up against are the bad guys. Saddam's Hitler, Rouhani's Hitler, Maduro's Hitler, Castro's Hitler. Do you understand the pattern here? This is national myth presented to the British public as reality. We are the good guys, we are never the bad guys, and our troops can never commit atrocities. Until we break free from these shackles of false consciousness, then I say the world will always be in a perennial state of destabilization, of chaos, of mayhem, and of huge human suffering. Peoples of the global south cannot afford our propaganda any longer, because it has been the result, it has been the product of their unremitting suffering. We must bring this to an end, and it's incumbent on people like me and Jonathan to be people in the West, in Britain, to make that case unremittingly, regardless of the personal cost to us and our careers.
Well, Jonathan, when the U.S. treats an international organization in the way that Washington treated the ICC, doesn't it show the lack of sovereignty and legitimacy that perhaps the ICC has to begin with?
Well, of course, the United States and its behavior is a particular case, which one shouldn't generalize with other countries necessarily in Europe. The United States has never been shy of putting pressure on other countries or institutions such as the ICC, and as you know, it refused to engage with the ICC and has withdrawn from other international treaties and organizations because it refuses to accept the universal nature of the international law and the rule of law. And as we've seen with the policy towards Iran, of course, and with maximum pressure under the Trump administration, they are prepared in Washington not only to put pressure from America, but also to coerce other countries to try to get them to follow suit. One hopes that this situation will change over the coming months, and certainly there is great resistance amongst many European countries into being coerced in that way, and there's great support for the work of the ICC amongst most European member states.
Well, John, the majority of cases prosecuted by the ICC deal with African countries. It seems to hint at the high level of abuse which has been committed by African leaders. However, if we look at the number of people killed and affected in Afghanistan and Iraq by the U.S.-led coalition, one would assume that countries such as the U.K. and the U.S. should be at the top of the agenda of ICC for investigating and prosecuting war crimes. Your thoughts?
Well, Malcolm X said it best. I mean, if you don't understand what's going on in the Congo, you can't understand what's going on in Mississippi. There is a circular relationship between the social and economic injustice taking place in Western countries and the foreign policy of imperialism, colonialism, and oppression that is underway perennially by those same Western countries. And people who are the victims of oppression in those Western countries, until they wake up to the reality of their condition and the whys and wherefores, then there will never be freedom for the rest of the world. And I just hope and pray that people in the US, people, the 40 million who lack healthcare, the families of the over 200,000 who have died from COVID, the families of the over 60,000 who have died from COVID in the UK, they wake up to the reality and move beyond the propaganda, the flag waving, the nationalism, the sense of patriotism. Until they move beyond that, then the world, never mind themselves, but the world will not be free. And I look forward to that day happening soon. I really do hope so.
Well, we all hope so, that's for sure. But Jonathan, when there is so much inequality in the international arena, even the criminal court, doesn't this send a message to developing countries that they must strengthen themselves militarily because might makes right?
Well, I certainly would agree that developing countries have every reason to be disappointed, to put it mildly, in the way that the ICC has tended to focus on Africa. There have been a few other cases recently which are a little more broad, but I would not particularly want to urge countries to spend their scarce resources on yet more military weapons. One of the problems of developing countries, including in Africa, is that too many governments spend far too much on arms and not enough on making sure that their populations are properly fed and educated. So although I can understand the resentment, I think rushing out to buy more arms is not the answer.
What your thoughts on that, John? Because it seems that that is exactly the signal that is being sent, that you have to be strong militarily, and basically you can get away with anything. Now, what Jonathan said when talking about African countries,
in theory, Jonathan's absolutely correct, but in reality, they have no choice because they're under risk of being invaded. Ask Muammar Gaddafi's ghost if he should have spent more money on arms, if he should have given up his chemical weapons program in 2003 when he did. Ask the people of Iraq. Ask the people of Iran who are suffering under these barbaric sanctions if they think their country should spend less on arms in order to put up a deterrence against the vultures that are circling their country right now. No, look, this is all about racism. It's racism writ large. It's colonialism, it's imperialism in our time. And imperialism is the external oppression of white supremacy. And until we move beyond white supremacy, there will be no progress and there will be no emancipation for the entire world.
How do we move beyond, John? How do we move beyond this white supremacy? What's
well, we
key right now?
Beyond it. We are living in a period of interregnum between the dying of the old world and the the coming into being of the new. The rise of China, the strategic threat of Russia, that is the new world. The sun is setting in the west and it's rising in the east. But in the period in between is a period of struggle. And it's a very dangerous period because no empire leaves the stage of history without a hard-fought struggle. And that struggle is being waged now. And I just hope that the people of Iran, of Venezuela, of Cuba, of Russia and China continue to hold the line, because people in the West of consciousness and conscience are depending on them to free us all.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me on this debate. Author and political commentator Jonathan Fryer out of London and out in Edinburgh. John White, author and commentator. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and other crew right here in Tehran.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Deen al-Islam, deen al-Arab, ghayr deen Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Going to talk about miscellaneous issues related to Islamic laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahth al-Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahth al-Kharij, he started Bahth al-Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Javid, is commission halal? I mean, the money earned or paid to a state agent, a real estate agent?
Of course, it is permissible. The commission is the money that you receive from someone for doing a job. You are not receiving money for doing nothing, okay?
Yes, or for doing something which is halal.
Of course, you are a dealer. For example, you are a state agent. You are not an agent, but you are working between the buyer and the property owner,
mm-hmm.
and you try to arrange the deal.
Yes.
And
to
for
close
the
a
work,
deal, yes.
yeah, for the work you are doing, you get some money either from the housing agency,
yes.
or the estate agency, or from the property owner, or maybe from the buyer.
Yes.
So as far as the there's the consent, and the money is paid with the consent of either side, there's no problem.
It's like the lawyer's fee, basically.
Yeah, the lawyer's fee.
Right?
Yes.
So it's completely permissible.
It's permissible, yes.
I see. How about monthly salary or wages even for holding congregational prayers or guiding or preaching in government departments? Is this salary permissible?
I should clarify one thing. One is, if you are offering your own prayers,
yes,
and a few people come and stand behind you, okay,
yes.
offering their prayers in Jama'ah, you cannot charge them for the prayer that you offer, because the prayer is obligatory for you and for those people. So you cannot charge people for obligatory duties. It is an individual obligation. It's not a collective obligation, okay? Had it been a collective obligation, okay, you could avoid doing it. Someone else would do it.
Yes.
So you could charge, if you wanted to do it, you could charge, you could get some money, you could get paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, there are some other services that you might offer, like for guiding and preaching and government departments, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
There's no problem in receiving wages for preaching. There's no problem in receiving and fixing even money for these things.
Because there is another third party involved, you mean?
Of course, there is. Whether there is a third party involved or not, because you are either working for, let's say, for a preaching organization,
yes.
like we have in the Islamic Republic of Iran, we have
an
Islamic propagation organization. You
yes.
work as a preacher for that organization, and you get paid by that organization. Or maybe there is a charitable organization which is willing to pay
mm-hmm.
you.
Yes.
So there's no problem whatsoever in receiving money for the work you do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. What about the wages that some people, in fact, receive, or even salaries, for teaching a person, an individual, to recite the Quran or to say the prayer? Is it permissible? I mean, this kind of wage that some people ask, the teacher, in
yes.
fact, asks for a kind of tuition, for example, fees.
You know, it's highly recommended to teach prayer and to teach the Quran. Okay, and it is actually obligatory for someone to learn to pray. Okay, yes. It is obligatory. It's also obligatory for a person to learn how to fast, the rules of yes. fasting, the rules okay. of prayer, and these are obligatory. But if there is someone who is willing and volunteering to teach the prayer or teach the Quran, he can charge for it. He can ask for money. And of course, the money that he receives from the student is halal. There's no objection to that person receiving money.
I see.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
What about the kind of payment? Is it permissible to ask for payment in order to perform ghusl or wash a dead body?
Ghusl, giving a ritual ghusl to a dead body is a collective obligation. A collective obligation is an obligation in which all duty-bound Muslims are under the obligation to perform it.
Yes.
And if all of them refrain from doing it, from fulfilling that obligation, all of them are considered to be sinful. And therefore, if one of them, one out of among them,
yes.
undertakes to fulfill that obligation, other Muslims, other duty-bound Muslims
are relieved
of the obligation to fulfill it.
I see.
So for such obligations, for such duties, it is permissible for a person to receive money, to receive wages. And we do have in our cemeteries, in our yes. graveyards, there are people in the cemeteries.
Yeah, they are trained to do so.
They are trained, yes, for this purpose. And they receive wages because they have their families to support financially.
Right. Yes.
So there is no objection to them receiving wages for giving ghusl to the dead bodies.
Does it matter or does it make a difference where the money comes from? I mean, they are paid by an organization, like a third party, or no? They ask the person, okay. like the mourners of the dead person.
He can ask the close relatives, he can ask the organization.
Right.
Maybe that organization, maybe let's say, for example, there is a cemetery there. It is at the cemetery is actually, it could be, it's a management, okay? The manager of the cemetery, first of all, will charge the person because in Islamic Republic of Iran, the graves are sold. And
you mean sold to the private sectors?
Yeah, to the individuals, private individuals.
Yes,
the people who lose a family member, they have to pay for the services that are rendered
mm-hmm.
for the grave. And of course, it's not the individual, the person who is responsible to wash, to give ghusl to the dead body, who goes directly to the heirs or to the relatives. He takes his money from the management,
mm-hmm.
okay? And so when it comes to the money he receives, of course, the money is halal and there is no objection to him.
Mm-hmm. Sheikh Javid, is it also religiously permissible to get paid for reciting a marriage contract or even undertaking the wedding ceremonies, for example? We know that there are some people who are somehow qualified, either by the government or by private sectors, to undergo all the processes which are used or involved in terms of, for example, wedding ceremonies and stuff like that.
Of course, there's no doubt as to the fact that it is absolutely permissible for an individual to receive wages for rendering services like this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
Like we see in the Islamic Republic of Iran, there are clergymen who are permitted and who have license, for example, yes. for doing this. They represent the notary office.
Yes, exactly.
And they actually read the formula of nikah on behalf of the bride and the groom.
Yes. Okay.
And of course, there's no problem in the salary that he receives. It's halal. And the same is the case with all the such other contracts that are, let's say, consummated or actually concluded, and there is a person, an individual,
yes.
involved. He receives wages for that contract, for concluding that contract, or for bringing those two parties together and finalizing the contract.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Around the world with reporters. Britain woke up to more worrying news this December morning. 1,800, 19,000 fewer workers out of paid employment in November than at the start of the health crisis, meaning coronavirus continues to weigh heavily on the UK labour market.
Is this the direct impact of the pandemic on the UK's labour market?
The problem started before the coronavirus, and the measures being taken are only glossing over the realities. The system is fundamentally flawed. Rich-poor division has got more extreme. The type of jobs coming in are not the old secure, well-paid jobs. They're the insecure, low-paid, temporary jobs.
Released by the Office for National Statistics, the report also says there has been a record rise in redundancies in the 3 months to October, 370,000 of them. Worst hit, those in the hospitality sector, teetering during the pandemic. The government says its measures are necessary for beating the virus.
We've put a lot of work in over the past month. It's been enormous sacrifice on everyone's part, and we want to make sure that we continue suppressing the virus. The good news is that we've made improvements, whether it's in mass testing or early promising news on vaccines.
While the prospect of a functioning vaccine has injected some optimism into people's lives, experts say the next few months are likely to remain very challenging.
Do you think more people are going to be out of work in the coming months?
Yes. They will falsify the figures, and they do that they've done this for years and years, and they massage out of the figures people who are really unemployed.
Add to the mix the immediate impact of a no-deal Brexit, the UK leaving the European Union without a trade deal at the end of this month.
There's also the fact that the unemployment figures don't tell the whole story. There's always a lag in the data. And the government's job retention scheme, also known as the furlough scheme, is propping up the labor market, for now.
In November, the UK Chancellor warned the number of unemployed people in the country was expected to surge to 2.6 million by the middle of next year, and that may be a conservative figure. The fact is that COVID-19 is here to stay, and it'll be months, if not longer, for everyone to be vaccinated. The unforgiving equation is that the tighter the measures to protect lives, the more devastating the impact on livelihoods. Saeed Pariza, London.
Italy's petrol station operators have been staging a strike since Monday to demand the Italian government being included among the recipients of support measures to mitigate the nefarious impact of the anti-COVID restrictions. It is the latest in a string of petrol station strikes over market conditions and aid measures during the pandemic emergency. In late November, another three-day strike had been called by sector unions and organizations and staged on the country's motorways.
Petrol retailers' associations complained that gas stations suffered losses amounting to 90% of their revenues on Italy's motorways and about 60% of their income in urban areas during the lockdown. They say it is no longer possible to meet overheads and fixed costs in the current situation.
Small and very small petrol station operators have been excluded from receiving aid payments from the government because all petrol stations remained open during the lockdown. Considering the cancellation of sales due to COVID and restrictions, we are at risk of no longer being able to guarantee the opening of stations with continuity and regularity.
Last month, the Italian government issued a package of aid for the businesses and families most affected by the new anti-COVID restrictions. As many as 211,000 companies have received support funds totaling over 960 million euros.
There's no doubt that support measures to businesses and families have helped a bit. Having said that, the situation remains critical for many, unfortunately.
New talks between the government and retail groups are likely to be held in the coming days. Petrol station operators are slated to end their strike on Thursday. Max Civili, Rome.
A debate in the European Parliament has heard that the EU is far too dependent on the United States dollar, and there is a serious lack of political will when it comes to negating the effects of US sanctions.
The recent American economic sanctions against Russia, Iran, and Cuba, especially the extraterritorial effects, should be responded from our side. We need an efficient instrument to counteract these illegal sanctions.
Big firms such as Airbus, Peugeot and Citroen want to do business with countries like Iran, but are being told by the Trump administration that if they do, they will not be able to trade with the United States.
In relation to Iran, the Commission is supportive of the instrument in support of trade exchanges, INSTEX, an initiative of three countries initially, Germany, France and the United Kingdom, and more recently joined by Belgium, Denmark, the Netherlands, Norway, Finland and Sweden.
However, many lawmakers say that EU instruments designed to bypass US sanctions, such as the aforementioned INSTEX and also the so-called blocking statute, are dysfunctional.
Some analysts argue that European Union foreign policy has been very negatively influenced in recent years by Washington, and that ultimately it is ordinary, hard-working EU citizens who are paying the price for that.
This is because millions of additional jobs could be created if the EU more effectively counteracted US sanctions. Countries like Iran, Russia and Cuba represent huge markets.
It does not only affect EU businesses, but also puts into question the political independence and ultimately the sovereignty of the EU and its member states.
Apparently, hypocrisy is rife. For example, the EU and US shy away from imposing sanctions on Israel and Saudi Arabia, despite the atrocities these regimes commit against civilians in Palestine and Yemen.
It's a fight for global domination of the West, led by the United States of America, but unfortunately, in this fight, they stamp over the very same rules they proclaimed they are struggling for.
And he has lost on the merits.
EU lawmakers have expressed hope that the Joe Biden administration will be less aggressive with respect to sanctions. However, they are calling on the EU to quickly develop policies to try and deliver strategic autonomy for the bloc. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Israel's municipality in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, has approved the building of 8,300 new settler units. According to Israeli media, the settler units are set to be constructed for residential, industrial, and commercial purposes. The new settler units will be built on lands from Beit Safafa, Malha, and Al-Baqa villages in Al-Quds, and all the way to Al-Walaj village, northwest of Beit Lahem in the occupied West Bank. Experts say the construction is scheduled to begin by 2021, and work will continue until 2040.
It's a long-term colonial project that goes until to 2040. This is located mainly on the both sides of the Green Line from the south of the Jerusalem, an area called Tel Aviv. It's taking what has been left from Beit Safafa village, Palestinian village there, and to connect also the settlements, the blocks of the settlements with the south of Jerusalem, what we called it Greater Jewish Jerusalem, that reach up to Gush Etzion, about 40 kilometers south of Jerusalem.
In addition to the new settlement units, Israel revealed earlier new projects, including building dozens of roads between settlements through a master plan, the first of its kind in years, to establish a transportation network in the settlements. The Palestinian National Bureau for Defending Land and Resisting Settlements accused Israel of expanding the settlements in the West Bank by constructing new roads. They say the move is a clear indication that Israel carries on with its plan to annex large parts of the occupied West Bank.
It's part of a larger plan of colonization. The Israeli occupation is racing against time to change the demography of the region. It is seeking to achieve its project, known as Greater Jerusalem, by 2040. Israel plans to establish a state for settlers inside the Palestinian state.
Observers say through settlement expansion, Israel is looking to ensure that within the next decade, 1 million Jewish settlers will live in the occupied West Bank. Today, there are about 500,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank, with almost 250,000 more living in Jerusalem, Al-Quds.
Palestinians say all indications prove that Israel is racing against time to build a new settlement before the outgoing U.S. administration leaves office. The Palestinian Authority has warned that settlement activity has grave consequences in the occupied West Bank and will definitely lead to more Palestinian land grab by the Israeli regime to facilitate the annexation of the occupied territories. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
More than 4 years since Britain voted by 52-48% to leave the EU, a trade deal is yet to be reached. After it became clear that the UK is hurtling towards a no-deal Brexit, Prime Minister Boris Johnson said Sunday the two sides are still very far apart on some key issues, but the UK will not be leaving the negotiating table.
What I'll say is I think that the UK should continue to try. And I think that's what the people of this country would want me to do. We're going to continue to try.
Mr. Johnson also called on Britain to get ready to trade on World Trade Organization terms. The UK will also have to decide whether to accept the mini-deals proposed by Brussels to keep planes in the air and lorries with food and medicines rolling. A no-deal might mean rising food prices and the loss of 300,000 jobs. So are Britons worried?
There's scary things like there might not be food on the shelves, like in January and February, because it's going to be a nightmare getting everything through customs. There's the whole Irish border thing. I mean, I can just go on and on and on.
I think, you know, leaving the European Union is a very, very bad idea. I think the decision was probably made by the old people, and the young people have to cope with it in the future.
Boris has let everybody down, left, right and centre. He promised the earth, he promised this ready-cooked deal, and he's just not delivered in any shape or form. It's dreadful. But on the other hand, we can't be blackmailed by Europe.
Preventing a deal is a row over Britain's fisheries. After January 1st, Europe won't have automatic access to British waters anymore, and a no deal will mean zero access. The French are particularly upset about this. Clashes in the English Channel are likely, and the UK has already bolstered its defences there with four Royal Navy ships. The EU is calling for calm, though.
Great Britain and Europe are friends, partners, allies, and this will remain the case after Brexit.
The EU's Brexit negotiator is also calling for patience, saying a new trade pact with Britain is still possible this week.
Trade of goods and services, fishing, energy, transport, the security of citizens. Never have we negotiated such an agreement in such a short space of time. We've only been negotiating for 9 months.
The EU says that Westminster has to compromise on fisheries, but the UK says it cannot be the only country in the world that does not have sovereign control over its fishing waters. Neither seem prepared to budge, and despite a new deadline, it seems a no-deal Brexit is more and more likely. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The US-backed opposition leader Juan Guaido has once again tried to cause instability in the country by staging a protest vote. Guaido launched a so-called popular consultation vote, asking people to dismiss the legitimacy of the parliamentary elections and the presidency of Nicolas Maduro. The elections, which was boycotted by the opposition, saw the ruling Socialist Party winning more than two-thirds of the seats. Although Guaido said millions of people took part in the event, very few people were seen attending the consultation polling stations. Government officials rejected Guaido's consultation vote, saying he has no political leadership to lead such an event.
Guaido's popularity is tumbling down, and every day he has fewer supporters. He no longer represents the country's opposition.
Nonetheless, a few still stand by Guaido and his political role.
As long as Guaido has the support of the U.S., he will be a political leader and his voice will be heard.
But analysts say Guaido's links with the U.S. are not enough to make him a successful leader, as many have abandoned him in Venezuela.
Opposition members who ran in the past legislative elections broke ties with Guaido due to his anti-electoral stance. His popularity is quickly melting down.
Opposition figure Juan Guaido, the guy who the U.S. still calls interim president of Venezuela, seems to be left alone by most of his former allies and followers, as fewer and fewer people respond to the events he calls own in his own country. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
The United States doesn't elect their leader by a popular vote, but by an electoral college. And that group has just chosen Democrat Joe Biden to be the president-elect of the United States. Biden was selected amid bitter, unfinished, but as yet unproven accusations of massive electoral fraud. Polls consistently show that around 35% of the country believes Biden won due to voter fraud, and the challenges to the nation's electoral integrity seems certain to continue until January 6th, when Congress officially counts the electoral votes.
Trump is going to just keep going on
doing what he does, and and that's not to the benefit of the country, but obviously we're just moving along, following the rules, and hopefully the democracy is strong enough to keep going.
President Biden is going to be in office. Yes, it's time for a change. He's gone. Good. Goodbye.
It now seems unlikely that incumbent Donald Trump can reverse Biden's projected win, and many wonder if Republicans in this gun-filled nation will take to the streets in protest. For months, domestic media stoked fears that a lot of right-wing violence will occur should Trump lose.
A lot, no. Could there be isolated incidents? Sure. But, you know, America is full of over 330 million people, and I would say that 99.999% of them will not do anything violent. They don't want to attack their neighbors, no matter what their neighbors' political thoughts are or how they voted.
However, it's hard to predict what will occur after such virulent accusations of fraud and the long-term demonization of Trump supporters, who did prevail at every election level except the presidential. Protests at Electoral College meeting places were held in multiple states, and the Michigan State Capitol was closed because local police said credible threats of violence had been made. A majority of Democrats never accepted Trump's win as legitimate, and now it seems that a majority of Republicans are opposed to the Electoral College's election of Biden. That makes for a worrying pattern, but the main concern right now is, will there be significant election-related violence? Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Angry reactions continue to pour in against the recent normalization of ties between Morocco and Israel. This time, Palestinian Legislative Council in the Gaza Strip held a press conference to condemn the deal that came at the expense of the Palestinian cause.
Normalization is not a normal. It's a misleading term. It is a misleading term. It is a false term. There is no normalization with the occupation in the history. Every country suffered from occupation, tried by all means to defend themselves, even by armed struggle, in order to liberate their land. For this reason, we are refusing normalization of any country, especially a country like Morocco.
Morocco is the fourth state to make such an agreement with Israeli regime since August, despite the Moroccan people's refusal of the deal that has also been struck recently with the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan. The Moroccan king claimed he agreed to start the relations with Israel to expand economic and cultural cooperation and advance regional stability and peace.
These deals can never bring peace for Israel. The current crisis will never come to an end until the last Zionist leaves our land. The normalization deals only embolden Israel to commit more crimes.
Palestinians call on the Arab nations to dismiss these normalization deals and protest against their leaders' decisions that Palestinians consider a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause.
Israeli regime should be put on trial for its crimes and violations of Palestinian rights in the International Criminal Court. The Arab nations should voice their anger at the normalization deals.
U.S. used Morocco's Western Sahara claim as a bargaining chip in talks with Morocco to secure the deal and agreed to recognize Rabat's sovereignty over the territory.
While the fourth Arab country has started normalizing ties with the Israeli regime, Palestinians here stress that no deal can bring peace to the occupied territories. They say that resistance is the only way to defend the Palestinian rights. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
The recitation of a poem by Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan during a military parade in Azerbaijan Republic was strongly condemned by the Iranian lawmakers and the government officials. Right after his statements, which Iran believes may fan separatism among Azeri minority, Tehran summoned the Turkish envoy. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, in a tweet